This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
The surgeon said, "You're not going to race again, Janelle. You're going to be lucky if you walk again." There was an automatic response that came so clearly. And I remember having a full belief and awareness that I was going to come back to race again, and that if there was anything that I could do about this, if there was anything that I had to say about my future, then I was going to take that on.
In this episode, I talk with Janelle Morrison, an ultra marathoner and educator who beat the odds, recovering and racing again 2 years after a devastating crash landed her in the ICU in a coma with broken bones throughout her body. You'll hear the surprising thing that she learned about self-compassion and what it takes to be a true hero. We talk perfectionism, heartbreak, overcoming adversity, and how we can help our students to become their best selves while holding on to a sense of unconditional acceptance of themselves, no matter their situation. You can learn more about Janelle on JanelleMorrison.com. Hope you enjoy. Janelle Morrison, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. I'm really, really excited for our conversation.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to share whatever nugget to help support teachers and classrooms and the education system.
Awesome. So I first want to acknowledge that you yourself started off in your career as, I think it was a grade 5 teacher. And I just want to know, what drew you to the classroom in the first place?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I don't know if anyone's ever asked me that. So yes, I was a grade 5 teacher in my final year teaching. I taught grade 4 and 5. And then prior to teaching in Canada, I taught in Taiwan for 3 years in grade 3. So it was a mostly elementary, middle elementary kind of age group. And I think what brought me to it was I started with a psychology degree in university and graduated from that and thought, okay, now what am I going to actually really do? And I knew I loved people, and I you know, had spent time with kids, and I love kids. I love their joy. I love their curiosity. And so I went into a bachelor, the after degree program, and that was that.
And can you tell me what took you from there to becoming a pro athlete?
Great question. quite distinct, aren't they? When I first came back from Taiwan that first summer, I did the Edmonton Marathon, and I had started running when I was in Taiwan, just mostly to keep fit. Like, I had no specific goals. I used to be a cyclist. I used to do a lot of road racing, provincial team, and that sort of thing. So I had a competitive background in endurance sport, but it was never an intention to really get back into it. Just doing it to stay fit, and then came back to Canada and entered the Edmonton Marathon. I think that was 2006, and won that race.
Wow.
And just over the following year, I started to train a bit more, and my times got faster and faster. And then I had an injury in my hip. I was working a lot as a teacher, as an educator. You know, there's a lot of time and energy that goes into the classroom. And I was also working on my master's degree, and I was training, and I was just overdoing it. When I look back, I wasn't present to that at the time. Well, I guess I was present to it, but I wasn't doing anything about it at the time. But when I look back, I was just like all cylinders, full steam ahead. So I got a hip injury, and then the hip injury led me back on the bike and in the pool, and started thinking, well, you know, what about Ironman? So I'm already a pretty busy person, but I thought Ironman, but I love the endurance aspect of stretching one's limits. So, I did my first Ironman race in August of 2008 and then won that race.
Wow.
So then realized, okay, you know, there's some kind of a talent here. And the only way I'm going to know what this means or what's possible, is to go for it fully. So I struggled with that decision for about 6 months, when that, you know, September to maybe March of that year in 2008, 2009, do I do this? You know, I have a teaching, job. I've got a stable income coming in. I've got a medical plan, a dental plan, and I've just bought a house. I'm in a master's degree. Do I really put this all on the table to do something different? So I thought a lot about it, and then that spring I walked into my principal's office and, you know, thanked her for all the opportunity of teaching at the school, and I became a professional Ironman distance triathlete.
Amazing. And so you did that really successfully for about a year or so after you left the classroom, is that correct?
Yeah. So the first race I did, so I left the classroom, obviously the end of June in 2009. And then I raced my first Ironman as a pro 2 months later and came in third place. So things were looking pretty good. And then something happened to shift that momentum, if you will, that was taking place.
Tell us what that was.
So in November of 2010, I was driving my car down the highway from Penticton to Calgary. And I was heading there for a spinathon fundraiser that Triat Multisport was putting on. And I don't remember what happened. I'm told all of this by paramedics and those who were on the scene, that just outside of Revelstoke, an oncoming van crossed the center line and threw myself and my car down a 30-foot embankment. I was in the car for, I guess, 3.5 hours, and the jaws of life finally got me out of the car and air evacuated me to the nearest ICU hospital in Kamloops, the Royal Jubilee. And they put me into a medically induced coma for a week, and surgeons performed miracles on my body. I had a shattered tibia, or I guess you could say ankle. My femur was shattered, broken pelvis, fractured vertebrae. My stomach had moved into my chest and pushed my heart over. Mm-hmm. And I had a ruptured diaphragm, a punctured lung, a broken arm, concussion. So I was kind of a mess.
Broken.
Really broken. And then when I came out of my coma, the surgeon said, you know, you're not going to race again, Janelle, and you're going to be lucky if you walk again. And so it was time to make a decision on what to do with that news.
What went through your head when you because I'm sure for a while after the coma, you must have been in a bit of a fog, totally.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would be like, actually, because that's never happened for me. But there must have been a sense of fogginess. And then what happened when your self-awareness kind of met with reality? Like, what was your thought process? Where were you at?
Yeah, it's such a great question, because self-awareness meeting reality when you're on morphine and all of these kinds of things, I don't even know what self-awareness is. And then concussion too. So I was so foggy, you nailed it. It just, like, the memories that I have of that time are like these little snippets of did that actually happen? But I do remember when they shared with me that I wasn't going to race again. There was an automatic response that came so clearly. And I remember that more than I do anything else at that time. I remember having a full belief and awareness that I was going to come back to race again, and that if there was anything that I could do about this, if there was anything that I had to say about my future, then I was going to take that on. And it was just very, very clear to me. It's the only way I can explain it. I've never wanted to be like the 90-year-old in her rocking chair that's wondering what if. And I had also just left behind, you know, I had moved, I had sold a home, I had made every possible shift and adjustment to my life to chase this dream that I spent, you know, months wondering, do I do this? Do I not do this? But I had made the decision to do it. And then I thought, okay, so this is what's happened. This is the reality that I'm dealing with right now. And the only person who can say what to do with it is me.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I mean, that's a pretty audacious goal, first of all, to say I'm going to race again in the face of this pretty devastating news. And then the other piece is, like, I wonder what in your life gave you that kind of strength and determination. Did you have some role model that you kind of had your eye on, or a mantra that kind of ran through your head, or, I mean, faith even? Like, what was it that gave you this hope, this belief, this certainty that this wasn't the end of the road for you?
Such a fantastic question, the way you worded it. What gave me the hope and the belief, you know, mentorship, you know, I could look back on my past. I mean, of course, we all have people that influence us. I've always been a dreamer. I've always been that person that wants to know what's possible. And I think that was what caused me to make the jump to go into my principal's office that spring and say, I'm going to be a professional triathlete. So I think it's just part of what drives me and what inspires me. There was also here's where I want to talk about the hope piece and the belief is there was really that instilled in me. And there was also fear of, okay, well, if I am not an athlete, then who am I?
Right.
What is this going to mean about me? So it was really the best way I can describe it is twofold. There was the fear and there was the possibility that both drove the recovery at that time.
Wow, that's a great answer. And if you, I mean, before we jump into the recovery process, if you were, because I know that you're a coach and you encounter people, I'm sure all the time, who have had to recalibrate their plans and their roadmap because of these kinds of external circumstances. What is your advice to people when they come up against these kinds of roadblocks or even this identity crisis around, like, who am I if I'm not this?
So what I hear in that question is actually really two things. I'm going to speak to the first part of what I would say to someone who's just had some kind of life crash. So my crash was a crash, a car accident crash, literally. And then other people will have crashes. We all have crashes, all of us. As long as we're alive, this is part of the human experience. And and what I always have, one of my first questions is, so what's the opportunity? Mm-hmm. And I believe that we can look at things in two ways, and that is going to frame the context in which we move forward. So either the crash is the worst thing that's ever happened to you, and there are going to be times where you do think it's the worst thing that's ever happened to you, even if you do look at it as an opportunity. You're human. So there's the part of, like, oh God, why did this happen to me? Now what am I going to do? And there's the natural grief process. So that's absolutely the natural part of it. But then there's the choice of what to do with that grief, of what to do with what's happened. And the biggest question that I come up with that seems to make the most impact off the start is, what is the opportunity? Mm-hmm. And then looking from the opportunity, not just viewing it as an opportunity, but what are you now going to do about it? So you've got this opportunity. Now what's your action? What are you going to do?
I love that.
And then you asked something else too about, so what would I say? And then what was the other question? There was something else you asked.
I think just around how you would guide somebody going through that identity crisis of who am I if I'm not this?
Yeah, the identity crisis. It's so great because after a crash, whatever the crash is, whether it's a divorce or a loss or, you know, a job loss, a relationship loss, any kind of crash that we deal with in life, you're not the same person. Mm-hmm. You're not the same person after that crash. And it fundamentally shifts and changes you on a mental, physical, emotional level. And so the question, who am I, can be a scary one. It's like, well, yeah, who am I? Again, for myself, like if I'm not an athlete, who am I? And then it comes back to the opportunity of, wow, who am I?
Yes.
And that's where you get to go, okay, well, what is really important to me? And how have I been doing things in the past that haven't really been serving me? And now what do I get to do with that?
Wow. And that this is almost like the wake up opportunity that enables you to step into who you want to become, right?
Yes.
That's really powerful. I love that. I really like those questions too, because I think we all go through adversity in one form or another, and it can be really hard to find your footing if you don't have a clear process or a thought process that can kind of guide you through. So I really like that. So tell us a little bit about your recovery then. So here you are in the hospital. You've made this essentially a promise to yourself that you're not going to give up and you're going to race again. Doctors are telling you, no way, this isn't going to happen. What next? What happened?
Yeah. So I believe I have a natural strength with determination, and I used that strength, in an extreme way. So I used that determination to serve me in the way that I did it. I did heal my body, in which I'll share a little bit about. And I also used my determination to push too hard. Mm-hmm. So again, it's twofold. And so the determination was used in the way that, you know, I put that determination and my natural drive and will and constantly looking for what is possible. And I put that into action. So what that looked like was to do initially physiotherapy at least 3 hours a day. It was my full-time thing to do that. And then I called my coach in the US who I had just signed on to work with. His name was Paulo Sosa, and he's renowned for being one of the toughest, if not the toughest, triathlon coach in the world. And so I was fortunate to be working with him. But of course, a crash like that changes things. So I thought, you know, if I'm really serious about wanting to come back, then I'm going to need some guidance, and I'm going to need something to really pull me forward here. Mm-hmm. So I got on the phone and I called him and asked him if he would continue to support me in my recovery process. And he agreed to that. And, you know, I trained with rods and plates and screws. I trained on a treadmill. Initially, my ankle was one of the most significant breaks, the most challenging, if you will, breaks that I had, because as a triathlete, obviously you can imagine, you know, running with plates and screws in your ankle is not going to serve you. It's not going to be very easy. So I did get that hardware out, but before I got that hardware out, before it was ready, what I did to train my running fitness is I would train on a treadmill on a, like a steep incline, like a 10% incline. For those of you that are familiar with treadmills, it's a pretty steep one. Mm-hmm. Just running really slow to get those hours and those miles back in my legs, to teach my legs what to do, and getting the hardware out. And I just did what it took every day. I did what it took. And then I also want to speak to the pushing too hard, is the doing what it took. When I look back, and what I have to offer people now, is who are moving through their own crashes, is yes, it is doing what it takes. And it's so important to listen to your body and to yourself throughout the process. So the doing what it takes can easily be dictated by, I've got to do this, I need to, I have to, I should, rather than coming from, okay, what do I need today? What do I need in this moment that's going to help me fulfill on this goal? So you're not overstepping your needs.
Right.
And what I discovered when I did make my comeback, and I made my comeback and came back again, third place at Ironman Canada, came full circle 2 years later. I guess that was 3 years from 2009. But after that recovery, I discovered that all the pressure that I had been putting myself under to do this, and using my drive and my determination to such an extreme, was burning me out.
Right.
And wow. Yeah.
So after the crash, then it took you about 2 years to recover to the point where you were able to literally, like you said, come full circle and place third. But am I right in kind of assuming that it didn't feel as sweet as you thought it might have? Like, it's almost like it might have shifted, what you valued shifted, and the way that you pushed yourself taught you something about yourself and kind of this whole recovery process. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, so great. Again, you just, fabulous questions. It was, that was the second wake up call. Actually accomplishing the goal and recognizing that, sure, it felt great for a day or two, but even down deep, I knew that I was in the middle of a never-ending cycle, and that I really had a second chance. There was a film, a documentary that documented my recovery process called A Second Chance. And I was clear I had one, and I was not enjoying it. I was putting myself under so much pressure. And so then there it was, like, I've got a second chance. Am I going to keep doing what I've always done? And I guess when we first started talking today, I also shared that I'd always done things this way. I'd always pushed a little too hard. I had done a little too much, overstepped my needs for the next accomplishment or the next result. And so what I uncovered over that process was that drive, that need for me to fulfill on that next accomplishment and goal was again rooted in fear of, you know, how am I going to measure up? Like, my results were a way to prove to myself that I was worthy and that I measured up. Right. And so when that was possibly not able to be there, then it's just like, I just went extreme, like, okay, gotta have this. So getting present to, there's another way I can approach this. And first of all, I'm going to have to let go of who I think I need to be in order to make room for who I actually am.
That's really profound. Yeah. I think about that too. I tend to identify with that. I know a lot of people do, high achievers, that perfectionist tendency of see the goal and then do everything it takes to achieve and get there. And the flip side to that, although it's definitely what's valued in our culture, mm-hmm. is that high achievement. But the flip side is, yeah, you burn yourself out, you run yourself ragged. And then there's a piece of you that's like, am I actually living within the integrity of who I really am, or am I filling a void here? And so I think, like, what is your advice to people who might feel like they're on the treadmill filling a void, and no matter what they achieve, it's like they've never arrived?
It's just so much. I'd say the first thing is starting to get present to what it is that you actually value. And that as a culture and as a society, we are right now naturally, it's not natural, it's kind of a paradox, but we're naturally told what to value and what should be important. And many of us are moving through in this hurried pace of keeping up without actually being present to what we value. Mm-hmm. And freedom starts to take place when you get present to what it is that you value and start aligning your life goals and the actions that you're taking on a day-to-day basis, not just the goals, but the moment-to-moment, day-to-day, on how you're living that. So I would say knowing what you value is a critical piece in that. And then also what you referred to just a couple of minutes ago was the well-being piece. Mm-hmm. And so the way I like to approach with people that I work with, and even for myself, is yes, those goals, when you're pulling yourself towards a goal that you don't know how you're going to do, I'm not sure if there's anything more inspiring than that. Mm-hmm. There's like this, when you get up in the morning and you have something that's really pulling you forward, you can accomplish miracles. It's unreal what's possible from that place. Mm-hmm. And so to have the goals, you know, really align those goals to what is most important to you. And then to break it down, to come back to look at, okay, so how am I enhancing my well-being to achieve this or to accomplish this goal, to fulfill on this goal in the future? How am I fulfilling on my well-being today?
I love
what
that.
What am I doing now in this moment that is getting me closer to that goal? So still pulling towards it, but it's actually not about the goal or the result or that thing out in the future. It's actually about right now.
Right. Can you tell that? I mean, I remember you talking about, because this really pops out to me right now, talking about that experience you had on the yoga mat where you were like, you, because I also can identify with this, like, time is scarce. If I'm going to go work out, it's going to be a results-based boot camp, not like a chill relaxation, or it might have been before, right? Can you tell me about the yoga mat story and how that relates to your change in thinking?
Yeah, so I like to share that story because it's an example of how I'm just not myself as a culture too. We're in our heads a lot. We're mm-hmm. we're dictated by the inner dialogue of where we should be, and where we need to be, and what this moment needs to look like. And so when I went to the yoga class, When I first stopped racing in 2014, so I raced two more years after my comeback, and my body was resisting. And so when I finally did say, okay, time to shift things here, I did a lot of yoga. And I did it initially in a recognition that there was a shift that was taking place and that this was helping me with that shift. But I was also still craving the workouts. I mean, I had trained, 5 hours a day, and my body was physically addicted to exercise. Mm-hmm. And so I went into one yoga class. I did yoga twice a day, almost every day for probably 6 months.
Wow.
And it was an evening class, and I was expecting a flow class, a hot flow class that would be a little more challenging, a little more physical. Mm-hmm. And when I arrived, it was an instructor that I wasn't expecting, and it was a class that I wasn't expecting. And it was slow, and it was gentle, and it was... I'm just going to say again, slow. It was slow. And what I wanted was not so much even the slow piece, but I wanted a workout.
Right.
I wasn't getting a workout. And so in this class, I it was probably a 60 minute class. I don't remember, 60, 75 minutes. Throughout the whole class, I resisted every moment of it. And I was resisting the instructor. I was resisting the fact that I was there. I was telling myself I should be somewhere else. I should have gone for a run instead of come to this class. And at the end of the class, she said something along the lines of, as a culture, as a society, we pay so much attention to the big movements, the big stuff, which is a lot of times coming from our heads of that focus. And we're not paying attention to what our bodies are saying. Mm-hmm. We're not paying attention to the small, subtle little things that are here in every moment that are making, that give, that that create richness, that give richness to life. Mm. And I heard those words and laid down for the final posture, Shavasana, and they resonated in my whole being. And I got so clear that this class had been such a gift that it wasn't just this class. It was actually about how I was doing my life.
Right.
And that
the opportunity to look at that too, right? You talk about opportunities. This was the unexpected opportunity.
Yeah, the thing that was challenging. It was a challenging class. I didn't enjoy that class. But the opportunity was there the whole time for this incredible wisdom and joy and growth. Hmm. It was right there. And all I had to do was pay attention and listen.
And lean into it instead of resisting, right?
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you brought up joy, because I feel like this is a common thread now in your life, this element of joy. How do you invite joy in your life, and how has that shifted the way that you exercise? And I know that you're sort of training. Is that correct?
Yeah.
You're training again?
Yeah, so I made a deliberate choice to do an ultra marathon in August. I had sworn that I was never ever again going to do an endurance race, and I started realizing that I was missing it. I was missing that feeling of physically testing your limits and how great that feels and how good that is for your body, your mind, and your heart. And so when I started to realize that I was missing it, I thought, well, I'm definitely not going to go back to how I was doing this in the past. And how am I going to know that I'm doing this and approaching this in a new way? And it comes back to what we were talking about a little earlier on in having a goal, coming up with a goal that is like a container for you to practice moment by moment, day by day, your well-being. So this ultra marathon, which is called the Canadian Death Race in August, is my goal to pull me to enhance my well-being in the day-to-day. So how I'm approaching my training for this race is how am I eating? How am I fueling my body to feel my best? And how am I using that training? How am I engaging in the training? Am I doing this with other people? Is it joyful? Is it fun? And that's the key word, is joy. So well-being for me, my measure for how well I'm doing with my well-being is how much joy I'm experiencing in the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And if there starts to be a point where my joy level, my joy factor is not on, or not how I'd like to be experiencing it, then what's missing?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that the goal needs to be shifted. It's how I'm approaching that goal and who I'm being in the process of that goal, where there's something missing, and where is that? And there is, again, the opportunity. There's so much growth and learning, like, wow, that just came up again. Or how can I shift this to experience more joy?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And I would imagine gratitude definitely fits into that. And then also, like, is there a question that you ask yourself at the end of a training session, or sort of a reflection that you do just to check in? Because there's a difference between easy and joyful. There's a difference between, like, because I mean, anything that's worthwhile has a little bit of struggle. So what's your differentiation between the good struggle and the, like, this isn't good for me?
Oh, such a good question. There's such a difference between easy and joy. One way I like to look at it is that well-being exists outside of your comfort zone.
Mm.
When you think of those times where you're engaging in a goal that really lights you up, that inspires you, it's joy. And what takes the joy away is how you're moving through the process to achieve that goal or to fulfill on that goal that's requiring the shifting. So one of the check-ins that I do for myself, there's a whole, I could talk all day about this, but one of the most simple ones and something that's easy to offer here in our conversation is a question, is a simple question of, actually it's not a question, it starts with a mantra. And you talked about mantras before, and I have a mantra that I come back to when I start to have that experience where I'm not experiencing joy. So for example, if I'm doing a workout that is more challenging, or in any time in life, you know, it's not just in a workout, if I'm in a lineup in the bank and I'm not feeling joy, it's like, okay, well, what's going on here? So my mantra, when I'm acknowledging that I'm not feeling joy, I'm not aligned, I'm not in that space that feels good, I say to myself, choose to rise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my mantra. But I always, with anyone that I work with, I'm always, one of the first things that they'll do is create their own mantra. And this is what you use to put a stop on things. So it's not like you actually don't tell yourself stop, because that could be even limiting, but you have an inspiring mantra, 1 to 3 words, that is your stop. It's your pause button. And then you're following it up with the question, what do you need? So if I'm in a training session and I'm starting to feel tense, if I'm doing a tempo workout and it's starting to feel hard, then I'm recognizing that joy factor is starting to go out the window, which it does all the time. And I come back to, okay, so choose to rise. And that's the pause. That's the acknowledgement that there's something that's not flowing here.
Right.
And then the simple question, what do you need?
And your mind usually knows, like your body or your heart usually know.
Mind, heart always knows what to do. The trust factor with some of us in trusting that is part of the piece, but the more that you practice it, the more you recognize that you do know exactly what you need in each moment. And all there is to do is to listen to it and then take the action.
God, how freeing. How freeing.
Yeah. If I'm doing a run that's hard and challenging, choose to rise. What do you need? Oftentimes what I need is, you know, to focus on what's here in front of me right now. Mm. Or to relax my shoulders, relax a little bit.
I love that. I wonder, before we move on to our questions, because I'm mindful of time here, what advice would you give to somebody as they're creating their own mantra? Like, how do they get there?
It really is a personal thing. So I don't really have advice for the mantra other than a few simple things. It's something that is simple. So again, 1 to 3 words. It's not I've had people come back and share with me paragraphs of their mantra. I'm like, okay, if you can memorize that, that's awesome. But you need something simple, something that checks you in right away. Mm-hmm. So very simple, 1 to 3 words. And the other piece is something, a word or phrase, very short phrase that inspires you, okay, that taps back in. So for me, choose to rise is, okay, now what are you going to do with this moment? Choosing to rise is rising up. And then for other people, it might be something like, I know there's someone else I'm working with that says, I choose my heart, and someone else whose mantra is such a simple one word, trust.
Mm. Awesome. That's great. Can you tell us where people can find you?
Yeah, they can find me on my website. Probably the easiest it's JanelleMorrison.com.
All right. What does kindness mean to you?
Kindness means to me in the moment. Kindness is discerned in the moment. Kindness is realized in the moment.
What one quality or superpower does an educational leader or teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
Listening.
And finally, if you could print one quote on one of those cups that could be sold in big bookstores across the world, what would it be?
What do you think it would be?
Choose to rise?
Absolutely. Yeah, choose to rise.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Janelle Morrison, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's really, really applicable in so many ways to education, not only for the students that we teach, but I think in terms of taking care of ourselves as educators, we tend to be a high achiever bunch. So we need that message of it's okay to slow down. It's okay to really think, what do I need?
Yeah, that's so great. And thank you for that. And what I hear is also that educators, yes, it's a full-time job. It's a big job. I really get it. And the component of taking care of yourself for your own needs for what you need is so important. And then it also naturally spills over with the kids. I mean, as educators, you know that they are so in tune. They are connected energetically to what's going on. So when you're taking care of yourself, it gives that example for them to follow, walking the talk.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I loved our conversation.
Oh, I loved it. Loved it. Thanks so much, Morgan.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.